cetera. So we can say that we've generated bodhicitta. And so I'll just add a chant invoking the lineage. Dorje Changchen Tili Narodan Marpa Mila Choje Gempopa Pakmo Drupa Galwa Drikungpa Kagyu Lama Namki Tashi Shog. So tonight I want to share with you some of my favorite verses from the Mahayana tradition by Shantideva. And Shantideva lived in the 600s. So he was in the mid-600s. And he's considered one of the greatest masters of Buddhism. So when you think of the Mahayana era, in many ways he defines that era because the Bodhisattva vow stems from his particular verses. There are two strains of the Bodhisattva vow. One comes specifically from Shantideva. So the understanding of a bodhisattva, we're greatly indebted to him for his clarity regarding the bodhisattva's way of life. If we were to look at the Metta Sutra that we recited tonight, and we went to the section, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. That could be considered a goal to strive for in practically any religious tradition. When we think of the Christian tradition and the golden rule, love your neighbor as yourself. It's a similar understanding of the ideal that we have as human beings. The problem is it's hard to get to that ideal. And when we explore that difficulty, we have to realize that our mind is essentially a distinction-making machine. We calculate differences all the time. So this morning, my job was to sweep the leaves. I was sweeping the leaves. And as I was sweeping the leaves, I noticed that the driveway was cracked, so there were natural sweeping boundaries to collect into piles. And then there were some leaves that were more trouble than other leaves. They were going to cause trouble to the drains. So I watched my mind making distinctions about the leaves, grouping them into families, having distinct boundaries, describing some as more troublesome than others. And this is what our mind does continuously. I was just watching my mind judge some leaves as more trouble than others. So our minds do this quite naturally because our fundamental wisdom, our fundamental ignorance, is this dividing into self and others. That is what is the root of all of our suffering. And we can see that it's the root of the incredible crisis of compassion that we have now in the world, where we don't see all beings as our child, our only child. If we did see all beings as our child, our only child, we couldn't live with the Syrian refugees. We would be in Greece. We couldn't live with children walking out of the house and getting shot in Chicago. There would be an imperative if we were able to really see all beings as our child, our only child. So the magnificence of Shantideva is he takes us step by step by step to get from where we are to that incredible, wise, open heart. And he does it in such a way that's so very human and so exquisitely intelligent that it's quite magnificent. So when we think of the metta verses and the metta training systems, which are very, very similar in all the traditions, we often think of them as an emotional practice. And what Shantideva does is he takes us through compassion in a logical process. And I find personally that balance of going back and forth between the heart-centered emotional training and the step-by-step intellectual logic to be a really incredible balance. And the other thing that's magnificent about Shantideva, in this book, The Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, it's essentially him coaching himself. So if we think of the two pumpkins outside, it's not the saintlier one, it's more the grouchy one, that he's talking to himself and he's giving himself a hard time for not fitting into the ideal and trying to give himself a pep talk. So I get quite a kick out of his sense of humor as well as his incredible intellect. So in all the Mahayana monasteries, this text is studied, and it's studied in great detail, in great depth. And these verses are from the concentration chapter, and because we're recording it, I'll just say it's verse 90 on to the end of that chapter. And I find that these are the verses I go back to over and over and over again because their logic is so profound and so beautiful, and I think if I keep studying them, that one day I'll actually get it. One day I'll actually be able to pull up that root of ignorance. So we'll just talk about a few of these verses tonight, and I hope that you grow to love them as much as I love them. So if we look at the first verse on the page, strive at first to meditate on the sameness of yourself and others. In joy and sorrow, all are equal. Thus be a guardian of all as of yourself. So that's the ideal. Be a guardian of all as yourself, like a mother with their only child. Do unto your neighbor as you would have done to yourself. Then the following verse starts to ask questions about that in a really beautiful way. The hand and other limbs are many but distinct, but all are one, one body to be kept and guarded. Likewise, different beings in all their joys and sorrows are like me, one in wanting happiness. So it starts to talk about, and he uses the body as a metaphor in a couple of different ways, that we think of ourselves as having parts, very distinct parts, but they're one body. And in the same way, we all have the sorrows of samsara, we all have the happiness that we experience, and we're alike in the joy and the happiness. We are all alike, one in wanting happiness. My pain, in fact, does not afflict or cause discomfort to another body. Through clinging to my I, this suffering is mine, and being mine, very hard to bear. So even though we're all one in joy and suffering, if someone dear to me dies, I have a great grief. If someone dear to you dies, you have a great grief. But by clinging to the I suffer my grief, not your grief, right? Because it's about me. And other beings' pain I do not feel, and yet because I take them for my own, their suffering is likewise hard to bear. If we take other beings as ourself, then their pain as well would be hard to bear. And we see that in our family. If your sister, your mother, your father was suffering, their pain would be hard to bear, even though it doesn't cause you a physical discomfort, right? And therefore, I'll dispel the pain of others, for it is simply pain just like my own. And others I will aid and benefit, for they are living beings just like me. Since I and other beings both in wanting happiness are equal and alike, what difference is there to distinguish me that I should strive to have my bliss alone Since pains of others do no harm to me, what reason do I have to shield myself? But why to guard against my future pain, which does no harm to present me? This is where things start to get really interesting. First of all, if we're the same in all wanting happiness and not wanting suffering, what is special about me that I should guard against my suffering or want my happiness and not want your happiness and you to be free of something? What is there so distinctive and special about this entity? So this is where he starts talking to himself. He goes, well, your pain doesn't harm me, so why should I care about it, right? And then he counters that with saying, well, why do we guard and shield ourselves from future pain? Because that's not harming us right now. Your pain is not harming me right now. My future pain isn't actually harming me right now. But I will, boy, you know, the minute you get your first job, you start your Social Security and your retirement fund to guard against future pain. We're always doing things to guard against our future pain, even though it's not right now hurting us. So how is it that your pain, which is not right now harming me, is not also to be guarded? I just love him. And I apologize for the typos. I was typing this out today so that you could have the verses to take. It is for the sufferer himself. It's your problem to shield himself from injuries that come. So this is really great. Your pain is your problem. It's your job to take care of it. But then he counters it with, the pain felt in my foot is not the hand's. So why, in fact, does one protect the other? We're talking about the body having different parts. This is the hand, right? It's not the foot. It doesn't have anything to do with the foot. The foot doesn't belong to the hand. The hand doesn't belong to the foot. But if we stub our toe, the hand goes to the foot. So this body we divide into parts. They're distinct and separate. At the same time, we act as one whole immediately when there's pain. I hope you get his sense of humor. The sting of pity aggravates, you say. The pain already felt, so why engender it? But can the sting of pity be compared to all that other beings have to suffer? So we might say, if I took upon myself the pain of the migrants, that would be hard to bear. I would have an overload. I would get burned out. And he counters that. But can that be compared to what those beings are feeling? You know, the fear you have of opening your heart and being overwhelmed, what does that compare to, you know, the mother on the raft in the cold with her children? And if through such a single pain a multitude of sorrows can be remedied, such a pain as this a loving being strives to foster in himself and others. So that sense of, if through the small pain of compassion or the small pain of empathy for the difficulties we see, you know, all around the world, if that can help in any way, because it would spur you to action, why, as a loving being, would you not cultivate that compassion and empathy? Because the multitude of sorrows that it could affect. Then he goes into how we create the I that we're so protective of, and how it's a matter of habit, essentially. Although the drop of sperm and blood is alien and in itself devoid of entity, yet because of strong habituation, I recognize and claim it as my I. So if we think biologically, you have the sperm and you have the egg. That's not you. That's your mother. That's your father. There's no I there. There's no entity there. They're alien to you. Then the second they come together, you start associating that with an I. You know, if we think of, was there an I at the moment of birth? Was there an I before birth? We can't identify how that I came because it is a habit of thought put upon those two alien substances when they come together. You know, it gets really tricky. Why then not identify another body calling it my I? And vice versa. Why should it not be hard to think of my body as another's? So when we're thinking about habituation and what our I is, think about the boundaries that we create. There's a sense of, in terms of me and my, you might say your mother and father are close to you as the me and my. Maybe your aunts and uncles. Maybe your cousins. We each have some way of defining where is the imperative of me and my and where we let go somebody else's problem. It's totally arbitrary. There's a habit of thinking that's not different from that alien sperm and egg coming together. It's the habituation. In my family, my parents didn't cultivate a big family. So when I think of who would I get on a plane for, it's a very limited number of people in terms of my family. I have a friend who cultivated a huge family. She is always on a plane. She has so many cousins and children of the cousins that no one can keep track. But she has defined that I, in terms of the imperative to help, as a habituation, is much, much larger. There is nothing that is essentially any inherent substance to that I, that me and my. It's an habituation that we mentally calculate. If you think of somebody adopting a child, the child is not theirs, then the child is their child. Most of us have the experience of getting an animal, a dog or a cat. It's not ours. Then it's this precious puppy that has to have all its shots. The day before, it was one of a million dogs in a pound. All of a sudden, it's me and my. So it's a mental habituation of where our compassion boundary is. And it's only the habituation that keeps it limited. Hands and limbs are thought of as the members of a body. Shall we not consider others likewise limbs and members of a living whole? Yeah. Is that gorgeous? Mm-hmm. And then for ecology in this precious place here, just as the body, which has many parts, owing to its division into arms and so forth, should be protected as a whole, so should this entire world, which is differentiated and yet has the nature of the same suffering and happiness. So he brings it back to that original logic of the limbs of the body. We have distinctions that we make, and then we have a mental habituation of making that set of distinctions me and my. Why not expend that to the living whole, incorporating all sentient beings in the planet? It's a mental habituation. Then he ends with the extraordinary dedications that you often hear the Dalai Lama quoting as his favorite verse. taking it not only to the present of the distinctions being expanded to a living whole, but as long as time and space exist, as long as there are beings to be found, so too shall I remain to assuage the sufferings of the world. So, limitless. The Brahma-Vihara is limitless. So, this is just a short talk tonight, introducing you to Shantideva, because he's so exquisite. And I encourage you to explore his guide to the Bodhisattva's way of life, particularly because this Metta Sutra that we all so love and adore, he breaks it down piece by piece, each section, showing in each aspect how to work with our very human, vulnerable minds filled with many foibles and kleshas to get from the grouchy curmudgeon to the gorgeous, loving bodhisattva that is our potential. Are there any thoughts or questions?
Question about, because you mentioned you use a phrase something like this is our compassion boundary. Is that what you said? So it's like we meet the edges of our compassion. It's like, goes that far any further? Can you give some advice on how to keep going when you meet that edge?
That's where I like the combination of the metta practice, and yours is very much like the Drikung lineage one, my understanding, combined with this logical one. So let's say you're doing the metta meditation and you're expanding to friends, enemies, and neutrals, and you hit up against a problem person. Then you can go back to some of the logical things to unwind the obstacle to loving that person and extending your full compassion to that person.
A little bit more about that. You look at what it is about them that gets you, makes your heart close.
Yes. He has a whole chapter on patience that unravels the distinction of enemies. And again, in a step-by-step logical way. So it's extremely, extremely helpful. I think it's a very real fear that people have, certainly when they're doing some of the trainings, that if they open their hearts, they won't be able to function, or they'll be in some sort of overload, you know, that you couldn't love every single refugee, you know, when you see thousands and millions of people in such great need. So then remembering some of the verses that we worked with tonight in terms of first uprooting our mental view, and after uprooting our mental view, that then would lead to action in the future.
Maybe Tonglen, you know, would be a good practice also, isn't it, to work at that compassion boundary?
Yes. So within this chapter in concentration, there are two main trainings. One is Tonglen and one is equalizing self and other. And I use the verses tonight from equalizing self and others. And those are two of the techniques that we used most.
How is that done, this equalizing self and others?
These were the verses in terms of seeing since I and others both and wanting happiness are equal and alike, what differences there distinguish us, that I should strive to have my bliss alone. Some of these verses lead up to it. And then some of the things that are very interesting as the chapter progresses is he talks about exchanging bodies with something with someone else so that you're looking at yourself from the perspective of someone else and going back and forth like that. So he has it's dense in terms of the techniques that are introduced in his classic text.
We have the book. I have the book. That one.
Yes, it's a very good book. Mm-hmm. It's amazing that this all happened in the year 600, you know, where there was that much information to be experiencing and gathering information out there, to have all that stuff there. And it really has never changed.
Human beings and the minds of human beings still have the same.
I mean, now we would think have more of it, but yet he's saying that was it.
Yes.
That was the entirety that he explored, and it's the same thing we have today.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
To play with.
Yes.
I wanted to say too, for Sister Nandavoti, that from whatever limited compassion I managed to get into my life and keep trying to, you know, I go into overload. I have struggled with overload a great deal. And I found that applying some of that logic you were speaking about, and for me that the logic gets applied when I look at that person and I say, what's possible here?
Mm-hmm.
What can be achieved?
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's just a smile. I mean, the feeling I have toward that person can be beautiful and unlimited, but what's possible in the interaction? Because I lose my patience when I see all the possibility and I can only function with that much.
Mm-hmm.
And then I want to push.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want to say, oh, look, what could be, you know, can't we? And then I've lost my patience and I'm in anger and I'm you know, basically in the soup, you know.
Yeah.
And if I just look and say, what's the one thing I can do here? And then the rest of me kind of calms down and goes, okay, well, that's where we are right now.
Mm.
And it helps me to function that way. Because I get a little fiery.
She's also got this magic bowl out there with all these words in her, so she'll come through the house frustrated, and she'll go to the bowl and pull it out and says, patience.
Yesterday. Goes, that's the first time I ever got patience of the bowl. But yesterday, I was tutoring, and I was struggling. I was telling Sister Jyoti I was struggling with the Skype, which was going all crazy. And I had two students, and they were just so upset, and I came through to get something from my office, and I said to Jim, I'm struggling learning patience right now, and I reached in the bowl, and Jim said, well, you're getting on track, aren't you? But anyway, I try to apply that little logic, and it helps me.
So there's always help out there.
Always, yeah.
So thanks for bringing in that book. I think it was probably, I would rate that as the best book. I mean, the best Buddhist book I've ever read, and probably a large part of the reason why I'm here. And many other Dharma books I sort of start and don't finish. And just that one, just so striking on so many levels.
Yeah.
Like I first encountered it when I was travelling in India 12 years ago. It was a significant kind of life-changing trip for me. And just still verses from that book will sometimes kind of pop up in my mind. And
yes.
Yeah, powerful, kind of crystal clear teaching. So, yeah, nice to have it coming into this shrine room. Thank you.
Yeah, the patience chapter for difficult times is quite extraordinary.
So if all fear, injury, and pain arise from grasping at a self, then what use is that great ghost to me?
Yes. Yeah. He gives himself a really vigorous. I'm going to defeat you, you enemy. Counsel. Lifetimes you've tortured me. Ego, I'm going to get you. Yeah. But this particular group with the why does the hand protect the foot when the foot doesn't belong to the hand? I love particularly.
Yeah, good example. Yeah.
So I know we all have to be up at 5, so...
You know what I particularly like is here you made a lovely typo.
The long.
Instead of loving being, you say long. The long being.
The typos. It auto corrects as you're typing.
Such a pain as this, a long being.
I apologize for the typos.
Because when I printed it out, you know, I changed a few little things, but this one I didn't see.
So, this is the classic Tibetan dedication that mind we call bodhicitta. So, bodhicitta, excellent and precious mind. Where it is unborn, may it arise. Where it is born, may it not decline, but ever increase higher and higher.
So. Mm-hmm.